A much-anticipated ruling from a federal appeals court about the future of the abortion pill, mifepristone. Expert analysis on what's next.
Lots of potential anxiety, potential nightmares, potential panic attacks and stuff.
The haunting scenes from the Hawaii wildfires. The Bishop of Hawaii joins us to discuss the survivor's journey to healing.
You can't take your life for granted as a man. You know, it's been distinctly and uniquely willed.
The struggle to be a man in today's world. Some Catholic thinkers say the answer lies in strengthening body, mind, and soul. We go in depth. And behind the scenes at one of the world's newest abbeys, how faith and vocations are thriving in the desert of California. EWTN News In Depth starts now. A much-awaited court ruling this week on the legality of the abortion pill, mifepristone, used in more than half of the abortions in America. The three-judge panel from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans has spoken. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. Ruling in a complicated case that has gone up to the Supreme Court once already, the Fifth Circuit panel agreed to reinstate some limits to the drug mifepristone, limits that will not take effect until the Supreme Court settles this case. Beyond the future of chemical abortions, the ruling could have wide-ranging implications for the Food and Drug Administration's authority. The lawsuit brought by the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine alongside other groups and doctors claims mifepristone is unsafe for women and makes technical arguments to assert that the Food and Drug Administration skipped proper procedures and ignored its own research and testing standards when approving the drug. The Justice Department representing the FDA says the drug went through rigorous scientific testing before it was approved more than 20 years ago. The panel ruled that the plaintiffs waited too long to challenge the approval of mifepristone in the year 2000, but that they could legally challenge changes the FDA made to the drug's use and administration in 2016, 2019, and 2021. In 2016, the FDA extended the use of the abortion pill from 7 weeks of pregnancy to 10. It also removed two of three required office visits and allowed non-doctors to prescribe the drug. In 2019, it approved a generic form, and in 2021, new guidelines allowed mifepristone to be sent through the mail and prescribed via telemedicine. With this Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling, the court would keep mifepristone legal, but reinstate the original limits in place prior to 2016, with use at 7 weeks maximum, required in-person doctor visits, and prohibiting it from being sent through the mail or prescribed via telemedicine. Despite the Fifth Circuit's ruling, there will be no change in how the pills are distributed right now, because last April, the U.S. Supreme Court put lower court rulings on hold while litigation continues. The Justice Department said it will appeal Wednesday's decision to the Supreme Court. The justices are likely to revisit the issue in 2024, months before a presidential election in which abortion promises to be a motivating factor for many. Aaron Hawley, senior counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom, representing the pro-life doctors, reacted to Wednesday's ruling, saying the FDA's unprecedented and unlawful actions did not reflect scientific judgment, but rather revealed politically driven decisions to push a dangerous drug regimen. Predictably, the reaction was very different from those who favor abortion access. Vice President Kamala Harris criticized the Fifth Circuit decision in a statement released on Wednesday. This lawsuit is a threat to a woman's freedom and makes decisions about her own body and another step towards the ultimate goal of a nationwide abortion ban. It endangers our entire system of drug approval and regulations by undermining the independent expert judgment of the FDA. The Biden-Harris administration will continue our efforts to protect access to abortion and defend the FDA in the courts. for expert analysis of the Fifth Circuit's decision and what's likely next for the abortion pill in the courts, we turn to attorney Mary Fiorito. She's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a senior advisor of its Catholic Women's Forum. Mary, it's so great to have you back. You know the history of mifepristone and the Population Council, the group that lobbied the FDA to bring abortion pills from France to the U.S. What went wrong in that process that then caused this litigation?
Well, that was very much a rushed process that took place in 2000. It was in the waning days of the Clinton administration. And as you note, Monse, the population control groups from France wanted these drugs to come into the United States. But the only way to get a drug like that approved was to use an expedited process that applies specifically to medical conditions that are life-threatening. So pregnancy had to be redefined as a life-threatening condition in order for the normal safety protocols to be ignored and for the drug to go right to market without really taking a good long look at the possible implications for it on women's health.
So this decision then from the Fifth Circuit leaned into the regulatory and administrative problems, lots of legal jargon with the way that this was approved. What does that then mean? How could that impact the FDA's authority in the future? That's something that has been coming out of Planned Parenthood and a couple of other groups.
Well, I think it's hurt the FDA's reputation. I mean, the point was made several times during the oral arguments that the FDA was acting in a political manner rather than in a medical manner. They were not taking into consideration the real effects of this these abortion drugs, not only on women's physical health, but also on their psychological health. Because, as you know, in this particular type of abortion, the woman often passes the baby's remains at home. And also as well, she is the moral agent in the abortion. So she is taking the abortion pill rather than the abortion being performed on her in a surgical way. And we see the FDA just sidestepping all of these very real dangers and concerns about the pill, and particularly when we're dealing with minors. We have no idea what the impact of these drugs could be on a young developing girl's body if she takes them. And so they sidestepped all of that because it was the political will of the Clinton administration and those in the abortion industry who wanted those drugs on the market, you know, whether or not they hurt women or didn't hurt them. So it has a real long-term impact, I think, on how Americans are going to look at the FDA. I think, you know, you see some suspect feelings already because of things that happened around COVID. And mm-hmm. I think this just adds another layer to how people feel about the FDA and how it's publicly perceived.
That's right. And we'll get to those reporting requirements in one second. But the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or APLOG, was also a plaintiff in this case and said it was impacted by the approval of the later use of this drug, so later in the pregnancy, because as doctors, they might have to complete abortion when these pills fail. The court didn't accept this, and they're considering appealing this part of the ruling. Do you think the Supreme Court will reconsider?
Well, I hope that they do, because I happen to know doctors myself personally, at least three doctors that I know that I have spoken to who have had to complete abortions from the abortion pill, not completely emptying the uterus. And what that entails then is a doctor who's on call in the emergency room, who doesn't do abortions, who hasn't been trained in doing abortions, and who ethically opposes being involved in any way in abortion, they essentially have to clean up the mess left behind when these pills don't work as they're supposed to. When it was initially approved, the RU486, the abortion drug, was only approved up till 49 days of pregnancy. And then it was expanded by the FDA, again, without any studies to indicate whether or not that would be dangerous, up to 70 days. And as we have learned, the later in pregnancy you use this drug, the more likely the chances are that the unborn child's remains will not pass at home as they are intended to. And so a woman can develop a very bad infection called sepsis. She will have severe abdominal pain and cramping, and then will usually go to an emergency room, right? She doesn't go back to the abortion doctor to be cared for. She'll show up in the emergency room, and that puts, you know, life-affirming pro-life doctors in a terrible position. They're not morally responsible because they did not give the drugs to this particular person to end her pregnancy, but they are still involved and they have to remove the remains of those child. That's incredibly traumatizing.
Yes.
I think for anybody, but especially for doctors who have stated oppositions to participating in this kind of medicine.
That's right. Well, really quickly, right now, there doesn't seem to be a path to banning mifepristone, at least not with this case. What is the most that this case could achieve going back to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think what we can achieve is to make sure that if the drug is going to be remain legal, that first of all, we'll know specifically how many women are harmed by it each year, that there will be specific reporting requirements put back in place, not just to report women who have died. And there have been 29 deaths that we know of, and there's probably many more, but actually that these injuries are coded properly, that they're not coded as miscarriages, that they are coded as failed abortions, so that we'll know exactly what this drug is doing to the women who take it. Secondly, I think reducing the amount of time from 70 days back down to 49 days. And then also, I think we need to put safeguards back in place that will protect women from being coerced into taking this drug or from the drug being slipped into something that they're eating or they're drinking. We saw this happen in Great Britain when they decided to make their drugs available. They called it pill by post. Mm-hmm. And they've actually pulled back on that tremendously because of the number of women who reported that they were tricked into taking the drug that they didn't even know they were taking it.
That's
so there's
horrifying.
Tremendous potential for abuse here and for harm to women. And at least, again, it's certainly I would rather it be outlawed altogether. But if we can't have that, then at least put the guardrails up so that it doesn't continue to damage women and that the public knows exactly what they're dealing with when they say that they have abortions available in pill form, do-it-yourself abortions. It's much, much more strenuous
and dangerous than people
study
know.
Needs to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. Mary, thank you so much. We look forward to having you back as this case continues.
Thank you for having me, Madsi.
The other major story we're following this week, Hawaii. Coroners, pathologists, and technicians arrived on Maui on Tuesday to help with the grim task of sorting through remains in a mobile morgue unit following the deadliest wildfire in the U.S. in a century. The number of lives lost has now surpassed 110, and amid the rubble and ash left behind, first responders and cadaver dogs are painstakingly searching for more victims. More than a week after fires incinerated the historic town of Lahaina, they have secured 30% of the burn areas. Many of those lucky enough to survive are now homeless. Thousands of evacuees are spread across shelters on neighboring islands and are being transitioned into hotels or Airbnbs. Some victims are receiving aid from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to cover the cost of food, water, and medical supplies. The trauma many experienced is difficult to comprehend.
I spoke to one gentleman who lost his home, his wife and kids, and his vehicle. And I think he said his job also burned down. So he's literally lost everything. So those are the kind of individuals that we're encountering who have literally lost everything and they just need somebody to talk to.
Experts say victims may suffer from anxiety, panic attacks, and more as they learn to accept what happened. Complaints are being raised now about failures in properly warning and protecting residents, as investigators still try to determine what sparked the fires. Sirens did not sound, and firefighters faced a shortage of water to battle the flames.
Nothing would make us more pleased if we couldn't go back in time and have a lot more protection from sirens. We will do all we can to get more water. We will do all that we can to get more warnings for people.
Under pressure on Thursday, the administrator of Maui's Emergency Management Agency resigned. In the meantime, Hawaii Electric is facing mounting questions for not shutting down the power grid when high winds created dangerous fire conditions. And now, days later, many remain without power and cell service is unreliable. President Joe Biden will be traveling to Maui on Monday to meet with wildfire survivors, first responders, and state and local officials. Bishop Larry Silva of the Diocese of Honolulu, which covers the entire state of Hawaii, joins us now to talk about the challenges Hawaiians are facing and Catholic Church's response. What are the current needs in Maui, Bishop Silva?
The current needs in Maui are for prayer and support of the people who have lost their homes, their loved ones, their livelihoods, and, of course, the funds to rebuild all of those things. We do have a website that through which we can receive donations, and we will have over the next few years, because this is going to take a while to rebuild, we will have the ability to help people do just that.
And now, you met with parishioners on Maui at the Sacred Hearts Mission Church last Sunday. We know that faith is so important during these traumatic times. What does shepherding them at a time of such devastation, what does that look like?
It was very sad to be there. There were about 200 people gathered there. These would be parishioners of the parish in Lahaina, which actually has the main church, which miraculously was spared from the fire, but it's inaccessible at the moment. But the people who were gathered there were telling stories of lost loved ones, people burning in their cars because they couldn't escape, the loss of homes, loss of jobs. There were a lot of tears, but a lot of hope. Our people really do have faith and hope, and I think that is what keeps them going. And I think whatever we can do to support their faith and let them know that they are loved is very important.
Now, you mentioned that viral video of the church that didn't burn, that miraculous occasion around it being that everything around it was reduced to ash except this church. And you talk about hope. What else can give us hope in these situations? How else are you counseling these families?
Well, they are very aware that people from all over the country and all over the world are reaching out to them and caring for them and doing what they can to help them. I think that is a great comfort to them. So please keep that up. Many people on Maui have told me, please come to Maui. You can't go to Lahaina, obviously, in that area, but tourism is very important for jobs, for the economy. And we hope that people will not stay away because of these fires. So that's one thing you can do is come to Maui, come to Hawaii. And, you know, there are many other places where you can be. And that really, in a way, will support the people of that island.
That's right. The worst thing that could happen now is also an economic collapse. Bishop Silva, you have the entire EWTN global viewing audience praying for Hawaii. Is there anything else you would like to say to them here as they listen to you?
Well, I am very grateful to all of you for reaching out. So many, even the Holy Father sent a message of support and prayer and blessing and you know, this really makes a huge difference to us. And of course, the rebuilding process is not a sprint, it's a marathon. It'll take a long time. And so we hope that we don't get disaster fatigue too quickly and we'll be able to support the people of this affected area throughout the years that that support is needed.
Well, we commit to you that you will not be forgotten, and we are praying for you and grateful for your courage being there to shepherd all of the people in this tragedy. Thank you so much, Bishop.
Thank you so much.
There's much more ahead. An important first ever gathering of clergy and lay people at the Vatican called the Synod on Synodality is coming up in just a few weeks. What could that mean for the future direction of today's Catholic Church? We explain next. Plus,
and I think there's plenty of examples in the church throughout the last 2,000 years that we can say, hey, what does it mean to be a man?
Searching for solutions in the church to strengthen men and their place as role models for the generations ahead.
I would like to see a new Catholic movement of fitness and health.
The Harvard professor known for his writings on how to lead a happy life shares some important advice.
It's obvious that young people want to be heroes. They don't want to have one foot in the world and one foot in religious life. They want to give their whole life to Jesus Christ.
And later, we go to California to visit one of the world's newest monasteries where vocations are booming. EWTN News In Depth will be right back. This coming October, the church will enter the final phase of the Synod on Synodality, when bishops, priests, men and women, religious and lay people from around the world will gather for 4 weeks at the Vatican to discuss the state and future of the Catholic Church. The global multi-year process consists of 4 phases: the diocesan phase, which sought feedback from parishioners, the episcopal conference that combined those thoughts into reports, the continental phase, where a document to guide the final phase was created called the Instrumentum Laboris, and now the final phase, the universal phase, in 2 sessions, one in October 2023 and the last in October 2024. 446 people will be taking part in the Synod. 363 are voting members, of whom 266 are bishops and cardinals. 46 lay people are voting. 30 of them are female. What is the significance of this Synod? What is Pope Francis hoping to accomplish? And why is there an undercurrent of hesitation about it? What is the significance of this Synod? And what is Pope Francis hoping to accomplish? Why is there an undercurrent of hesitation about it? We hope to explain that in our EWTN News Synodal Series. We begin with several interviews I conducted with Catholic bishops asking for their perspectives, and with lay Catholics how they should be thinking about the Synod on Synodality.
We've had synods of bishops since the Second Vatican Council, but this is the first time that it's been so drastically restructured to include so many more people and to extend over the period of a couple of years. And the consultation that has taken place has really been an attempt to hear from everybody.
Well, I think one of the reasons they should care is in preparation for the synod, we had these moments of listening. So to find out what, you know, Aunt Rose and Uncle Joe really thought, and, you know, maybe questions they had or concerns that were theirs. And so this was an opportunity for them to express those concerns. And in talking about the Synod with Pope Francis, he really stressed the role of the Spirit and the importance of listening. We're certainly rereading the Instrumentum Laboris, and we hope to get together and talk about it a little bit before we go over.
But it's more important is the way that the whole church, all the faithfuls around the world, just to realize that they are not apart from this journey, and they are as responsible as those who are in the synod. So I think the big support that they should give is their prayers.
To further explain and discuss the complicated structure of the Synod on Synodality, we're joined by our panel of experts, moral theologian Dr. Pia De Seleni, EWTN News editorial director Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and with insights into the Catholic Church throughout Latin America, EWTN Noticias anchor Eddie Rodriguez Morel, who is based in our Lima, Peru office. Thank you so much for joining us. Matthew, let's go to you. Talk to us about the history of synods. What are synods supposed to do in the Latin Church, in the church that is governed by the dicasteries and our Holy Father in Rome?
Yeah, well, historically, synods have been a part of the life of the Latin Church. The modern era, however, has seen, I think, the fullest expression of what the Second Vatican Council was hoping, and that was to have a deliberative body of bishops who would come together on a regular basis to assist the Pope on key issues facing us. The Synod of Bishops was, as we know it today, was established in 1965 by Pope St. Paul VI at the very start of the last session of the Second Vatican Council, because he considered it's so important for the future of the church in the modern world. Different popes have used the synods in different ways. There are 3 types. We have the ordinary, that's the one that's going to be taking place in October. Then we also have the extraordinary synods that have been used, for example, by Pope John Paul II on the 20th anniversary of the Second Vatican Council to steer the interpretation and understanding of the council. And then there are special synods largely focused on regional concerns, as we saw in 2019 with the Pan-Amazonian Synod. So it's really up to different popes and their priorities.
Now, Pia, as a theologian, you've heard that some people are concerned about the synod. Let's listen to what Bishop John Paprocki told me in California.
My fear is that people misunderstand what a synod is, that they think it's some sort of a parliament, you know, where people vote and it's like Congress or a legislature and they pass bills and then the bishop is like either a governor or a constitutional monarch.
What kind of an impact do synods traditionally have on what we believe it is and how we act as church?
You know, that's been such a far-ranging experience, Monsi. I think Matthew is right to point to Familiaris Consortio from St. John Paul II. I mean, that really shaped the direction and the emphasis of our theology of marriage and of the family. But more recently, what's happening is that many of the synods are focusing on hot-button issues. And so then, you know, to paraphrase Pope Benedict, we have the real synod and we have the synod of the media. And so what happens is people are hearing the headlines and it's the clickbait. It's what's controversial. And so I think this is what's causing a lot of the confusion. And this is why people are concerned. And at the end of the day, people are also concerned because these hot button issues, traditionally, we discuss those in academic circles. We pummeled each other in academic circles and until we hammered it out and figured it out and moved forward. And the way that the synod works is that typically each participant does a 3 to 5 minute intervention. So there's not a whole lot of time to really probe these ideas. And meanwhile, the ordinary Catholic, however you want to describe them, you know, if you want to describe them by their political affiliation or whatever, they're seeing situations in the parish, the day-to-day life, and they're wondering, how do we address that? Because what's happening at the synod is very high level, at least apparently, and people don't understand, where do I go to when I have concerns just about what's happening in my parish or what's not happening in my parish? So I think there's just a ton of confusion. And again, not understanding that this is a consultative body, meaning this body offers an opinion to the Holy Father, and the Holy Father can do what he wants with that opinion. It doesn't mean that he's forced to act in any way. It doesn't mean that a particular teaching is emphasized or changed or de-emphasized. It is a consultative body, and that's it.
That's interesting. Eddie, you have been covering the synod and will be joining us in Rome. What makes this synod then different?
Well, I mean, the makeup is something that's striking at first, right? The fact that there are so many non-bishops who actually have voting rights. But if we go to, I mean, I think what's most essential is the track record of those who have been invited by Rome to participate in this synod. And that's where you find, I think, the real preoccupation. The fact that, as they say, personnel is policy. So if you invite people who have a track record, for example, of LGBT normalizing activism, as does Cristina Hinojez-Sanz from Spain, who has also written against the Catholic doctrine on the sacraments. It's just that we have to rethink all of the church's sacramental practice. Women's ordination is something she argues for. She says it's not a theological issue. This is what she says. So there are people who you look at it and you say, man, these people don't seem to really be very, very competent, I mean, theologically. And it's something like the bull in the china shop. And this bull is really, I mean, he doesn't like the moral china. He's just going against it with all of these presuppositions that are more characteristic of a worldly mindset than of the mindset of the church. And you wonder why people like Cristina Hinojez-Sanz, why James Martin, in the United States is an LGBT activist. Why are they invited specifically to participate? Why do we want that voice to be heard within the synod deliberations?
That's right. And we do know that we have some voices on the other side that were also invited, Cardinal Mueller. So it really is a moment to get the popcorn out and listen. Matthew, under Pope Francis's now 10-year pontificate, quickly, has there ever been a traditional synod of bishops, or did he make this change right away?
No, he has maintained most of the structure of the Synod of Bishops that he inherited from Paul VI, John Paul II, and Pope Benedict XVI. He began, however, making some fairly significant changes around 2015. We look at that as the 50th anniversary of the Second Vatican Council, when he really began talking extensively about synodality and desiring a synodal church. The other big change came just a few years later in a document called Episcopalis Communio, in which he really reconfigured in some ways the potential authority of the Synod of Bishops. And we have seen since then an expansion of participation, culminating really with this synod on synodality over this 2-year process. And as Eddie notes, the variety and wide diversity of participation is pretty unprecedented in the history of synods. However, it is still about 73% of the voting members are bishops, so it has still a very heavy episcopal orientation.
But it's still new and different. Eddie, quickly, Bishop Andrew Cousins brought up Germany and the German Synod when I interviewed him. Let's listen to what he had to say.
We're all aware of what's going on in Germany, and we're even aware of what the Holy Father has said. He doesn't like what's going on in Germany in terms of the German Synod. And we're aware that there are people who have an agenda that's not the agenda of the gospel, right? And so the fear, of course, that those people would try to influence the church in some unhealthy way. For me, I really trust the Holy Spirit, and I think the Holy Father does too.
With the Holy Father denouncing this process in Germany, is there still a possibility of that synod influencing the one in Rome?
It already has. I mean, it has become like a blueprint for the more progressive, let's say, elements that have been invited within the synod. They actually, Christina Nogués-Sanz, once again, she praises what's happening in Germany as something that really is like exemplary for the church and how the church should see its synodal processes.
Well, Pia, Eddie explained that lay participation and lay voting is new. A theologian in Chicago, Father Louis Camelli, just this week said that we should consider not having votes at all. Why is the idea of lay people voting so confusing?
Again, this is something very new, so it takes us a while to wrap our heads around it. And it's an understanding this is not a democratic process. This is a consultative process. So honestly, I'm okay with it because at the end of the day, the vote is fairly, you know, it's subjective. It's not going to determine the course of the church. The Holy Father still is the Holy Father, and he is not governed by the synod. So I do think it's a gesture. I think it's a symbolic gesture because, again, we're talking about a consultative body, but this is something new, and so it's going to take a while for us to wrap our heads around it. And, you know, to Eddie's point, it's kind of confusing for people because we're looking at the participants, who's participating. And then I go back to the fact that most of the Catholics that I hear from are concerned with things that are much more immediate in their families, in their parish life, in their communities. And they're wondering, okay, well, if we can't talk about this at the synod, or if we don't have a voice at the synod, then where do we go? Who do we talk to?
And for women who are voting and participating for the first time, does this create confusion for us too?
I don't think it has to. I think this is, it's important to have these different voices in the church heard. And honestly, I mean, sometimes I look at some of the messes that we've had in the church and I think, wow, healthy, well-formed, educated women would do well in some of these positions. And I think we have to be careful, you know, following the example of Cardinal Pell, he used lay experts, women, his deputy was a woman, and he would often send her to meetings in his place. So we have to separate the sacramental, the governance of the sacraments, from the managerial. And the managerial part, I don't have a problem with lay people being involved. And in many cases, I think we should be exploring how this can be, how lay people can take even a greater role, simply because our presbyterate, our bishops, our priests are so overwhelmed, so taxed, that many of them get drawn away from the governance of the sacraments, which that's their primary responsibility. And they're being tasked with all these mundane worldly situations for which most of them were never trained. So to me, a perfect collaboration here of the lay and clerical, or the lay and the presbyterate, is to include lay expertise.
The disconnect between the theological discussions that usually happen behind closed doors and the practical applications to our lives. Thank you so much for this. We're looking forward to our coverage from the Vatican the last week of October. Thank you all.
The problem with manhood in the world today is that it's understood from a selfish and egotistical perspective.
A hard stop on toxic manhood. Some Catholic thinking ahead on how to lead a life of authentic masculinity. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
Manhood under the microscope. Popular culture, news reporting, and casual talk among friends point to a general perception that men's place in society is eroding. That is backed up with statistics about underemployment, educational stagnation, and dissatisfaction with life. Catholic thought leaders are increasingly addressing what appears to be a real problem. As Mark Irons reports, they say masculinity can flourish when blessed by faith.
What does it mean to be a man?
It's called discipline. It's called being a man.
Millions of men are looking for answers to that question, seeking influential voices online looking for guidance.
Put your life together. Stop whining.
Some suggest the old formula is all wrong. According to the American Psychological Association, traditional masculinity, marked by stoicism, competitiveness, dominance, and aggression, is on the whole harmful. Those were the findings of the APA in 2019 when it published guidelines for psychologists working with men and boys.
The issue is not men. The issue is not masculinity per se. It is taking an overly extreme, a rigid and inflexible approach to our lives in which I'm only willing to show up as the Marlboro man.
Call it traditional masculinity or toxic masculinity, a phrase heard in popular culture. Andrew Whiskeyman, a Catholic retired Army colonel and expert in military strategy, says something like dominance has a proper place, for example, on the battlefield. But any characteristics like competition or aggression, taken to their extreme, can be problematic. Still, that isn't unique to men.
Anybody can be toxic when they don't care about another person or they're selfish, or again, they take a strength, right position of power they have, and they use it to serve themselves and to subject others. Have there been men in the past that do that? Yes. Does that mean that all men are toxic or masculinity is toxic? Well, that's a huge stereotypical stretch.
So maybe it comes down to this question. What does authentic masculinity look like?
To provide, to protect.
To have the courage to do what's right.
People should live by certain standards.
But for me to be a man, is to be part of a society.
And perhaps asking what is a man and where did he come from is even more central. Scripture says God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Since man and woman were created in God's image with a united body and soul, human beings contain a spiritual and physical reality, an identity given by God, no matter what the culture says.
The greater identity of who we are as man and woman requires us to strive for the spiritual realm while still respecting and reverencing the physical realm. And what that does is it means that we can't deny biological differences between men and women.
With that as a starting point, yeah. Father Stephen Gadbury, a Catholic priest in Little Rock, Arkansas, says to be a man means to know you are a son created by God, a loving father.
You have to live out of your deepest identity as a beloved son of God, one who is loved into existence by this God.
And then comes commitment to following Christ and sacrificially serving others as a husband, father, son, brother, friend, or coworker. The mission applies to all men, whether single or married, priest or lay. If a man finds that to be a tough calling, Exodus 90 is trying to help. It's a spiritual exercise inviting men to strengthen their bodies, minds, and souls while working together through the highs and lows in a fraternal group.
When you can see God acting in another man's life, you know, with his own struggles and joys and triumphs as well. It's extremely motivating.
Jamie Baxter is the founder of Exodus. The organization provides year-round resources for men and taps into ancient practices the Catholic Church has always embraced, but in individual lives today are often forgotten, like silent prayer and fasting beyond the minimal requirements during Lent.
You know, we just have this belief that the Catholic Church is just a treasure trove, man. And so much has been forgotten, you know, so much has been neglected.
With the faith guiding men to seek virtue, they must also cut out vices.
It was pornography, and, you know, I would kind of get sucked into that.
Kurt Gibson hadn't shared that with anyone. Then a friend invited him to join an Exodus group. Through the fraternal group meetings, openness, and accountability, he eventually overcame his problem, and he found out he wasn't alone in his struggle with pornography.
It's a real battle that we're facing. And I think the more we talk about it, the better it's going to be to say to men, hey, it's okay that we're talking about this. We just need to figure out a way, okay, how are we going to find a solution? How are we going to help solve this problem that is affecting so many men?
To grow in spiritual well-being, Father Gadbury encourages men to take advantage of the sacraments the Catholic Church has to offer.
Go to confession. The church says once a year. I would challenge men to go once a month or once every 2 months at least. Weekly Eucharist, add in a weekday mass. I would challenge guys to do that once a week. If they would add one more weekday mass a week, I guarantee you they'll see a difference.
And he says don't forget to work on physical health as well. Father Gadbury takes his faith to the gym. So does Father Rafael Capo in Miami, Florida, emphasizing fitness of the mind, body, and spirit. In the spiritual life, every man needs a role model or mentor. And learning about the saints can provide guidance because they lived very human lives in love of Christ.
The majority of the saints were pretty rough. and all of them had different histories and pasts and even things that they lived with through their whole life. So getting into the nitty-gritty things, it shows their humanity.
He says Saint Joseph, the foster father of Jesus, is a great saint to pray to and ask for help. And if a boy or man is struggling and another man can offer some kind of encouragement or support, he should.
We as men need to step up and be fathers, whether we have biological kids or not, whether we're married or not. If we follow the example of Christ, then that means we go out and find the lost sheep.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
We continue the conversation about masculinity, men as faith role models, and fatherhood with an author and professor well known for his writing about how to build a happy life.
Are you manly enough to bow down before the Lord? And are you manly enough to bow down before the Lord in front of the people over whom you have total responsibility? Because that is an ultimate witness.
We continue now with our exploration of faith and masculinity with author and social scientist Professor Arthur Brooks of Harvard University. You may know him because of his advice on how to live a happy life. From his popular podcast on the Halo app to his columns in The Atlantic and The New York Times to the many books he's written, Brooks says four basic pillars create a life of purpose: family, friends, work, and faith. And his Catholic faith is strong. Here is Arthur Brooks on the record. Arthur, it's so great to sit here with you and chat a little bit about all the exciting things you have coming up.
Thank you, Monse. Nice to be with you and great to be with EWTN.
Yeah, this is new for us.
Yeah.
It's exciting, and
yeah,
especially on News in Depth. So we speak about what's really in our hearts. We talk about what's going on in the world and try to break it down for our audience. There's this one thing that I think is particularly interesting, the idea of masculinity.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Getting all controversial right from the get-go.
Right from the start. It's what they expect.
Yeah.
And you see it in different ways.
Yeah.
You've got Jordan Peterson, who takes it in one direction. You have priests who are lifting weights, Father Capo in Miami. And you have the Barbie movie with Ken blaming Barbie, saying, you've failed me, trying to define himself as a man. What roadmap do you have in discussions around masculinity, especially as a Catholic man?
You know, there's a million different ways to be a good man, but the whole point is that you need to be a good man. That's what it comes down to. And, you know, the fact is there's a lot more interest that's actually coming in all different communities and taking care of your body and being in shape, being a respectable person. And you know, this is trying to distinguish masculinity from what would be toxic masculinity. And I understand in the modern culture there's a way of talking about that, which is sort of any masculinity is toxic. But the truth is that we as Catholics understand that masculinity can be toxic when it's taken to the point that it makes us think that somehow men are better than women, or that it's something that we should be focusing on in denigrating women themselves or putting ourselves in front of women. And that's not the way it's supposed to work at all. On the contrary, we're supposed to love the way that God made us, and we're supposed to take care of our temple, take care of our bodies, and integrate that with our soul. And I think it's great that I would like to see a new Catholic movement of fitness and health, quite frankly, because this is one of the ways that we can honor and love our Lord.
What do you think about the way that men should consider religion? Is religion part of true masculinity as well?
Yeah, here's an interesting thing that actually, I'm a social scientist, so one of the things that I see is that, you know, I'm looking at the predictors of whether or not your kids are going to grow up and practice the faith. Any faith, but I care most about the Catholic faith, obviously. What's the biggest predictor in growing up to be a Catholic? You can look at where you grew up and what your parents say and how much money you have and how much education and all that stuff sort of falls out of the models. And number one, for two-parent families at least, is whether you saw your father practicing his faith. This is the number one predictor. Now, probably what this means is that when you're a little kid, the most powerful, physically powerful person that you see in your life, kneeling before God, has a huge impression on you. When I was a kid, my dad, I mean, I remember asking my brother, my older brother, Jeff, do you think Dad could lift the house? Because he was the most powerful creature that I'd ever, you know, laid eyes on. And my dad bowed his knee to no man. But he was on his knees on Sunday morning. No joke. And that has a huge impact. And that's a manly thing. Are you manly enough to bow down before the Lord? And are you manly enough to bow down before the Lord in front of the people over whom you have total responsibility? Because that is an ultimate witness. That is an ultimate witness of weakening yourself as a strong person in the time where it truly matters. That's, as far as I'm concerned, this is the ultimate Catholic manliness.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I know that's the idea of being vulnerable in that way is something a lot of people are scared of. Right. You talked about this during the pandemic at a speech with the Catholic Information Center. You said that men should be courageous. Go and ask that girl to date you. Go and do the things that make you uncomfortable. Why did you say that?
Well, part of it is that fear and love are opposites. You know, through love, there is no fear. According to St. John the Apostle, perfect love drives out fear is the whole idea. And this is actually a neuroscientific but also a psychological truth that our brains can't process fear and love simultaneously. That love is the ultimate positive emotion and fear is the master negative emotion. And so one of the problems that we have in our society is there's not enough love. I mean, we witness this around us all the time through political polarization, the way that we deal with each other, the fact that people are getting less and less happy and more and more and more fearful and lacking in love. Well, this is no coincidence. The fear that we have in our society is driving love away. And so the result of that is that if you want more love in your life, you need to deal with the fear. And the way that you deal with your fear is head on, is by looking that fear in the eye and stepping into it, having the courage to actually not to not have fear, but to deal with fear in a way. And what that will do is invite love into your life. The classic case is, I know I talk to people in their 20s a lot, I'm a college professor, and my graduate students are in their late 20s, typically. And you know, this, a lot of them have never dated.
They're in their late 20s and they've never dated.
They've never dated. And it's because they're afraid of failing in this way. And that failure is crowding out their love. So I say, you got to step into the zone, feel the fear, act anyway, ask her out. You might get shot down, but you won't die.
It's a nice comparison. Mm-hmm. Ask her out or die.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Happiness, though. You mentioned happiness, finding that fulfillment because you're courageous, etc., going there. You have a happiness podcast with Hallow as well, but also that is the theme. You have a book on happiness.
Right.
Well, you
have
many books.
Yeah. I teach the science of happiness.
That's right, at Harvard.
School. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Why happiness?
Happiness is what we all want. And ultimately, you know, what I found, I mean, I'm not working as a Catholic missionary, but we're all Catholic missionaries. You know, at the end of the day, we're supposed to sanctify our work and lift people up through our work and to introduce people to the beauty of the Catholic faith. I do it by creating a hunger in people for what they really want, which is to be happier people. The source of that happiness in my life is my faith. And when people see that, they want more of it. So I think I can, even people who don't ultimately become Catholic, I can enrich them, which I think God wants me to do. And then some of them are actually going to look behind the curtain. What's going on? What's animating Brooks in this work that he's actually pursuing? And they'll see my Catholic faith because it is no secret. I mean, they know how to use Google. Not to mention the fact that each of the 175 speeches I give each year, I make sure that no one leaves ever from any one speech not knowing that my Catholic faith is the most important part of my life. When I can link up the happiness, the bliss that actually is the center of, you know, what I've been looking for with the faith, which is how I found it, they're not dumb. They can put two and two together and maybe it works in their life too.
Yeah, they get to ask the question, what does he have that I don't? And maybe say, I want that.
What's working for him that might work for me? Oh, it's just a joy.
That's beautiful. When you talk about happiness, there is that paradigm of the overwhelming political reality that we live in today.
Right.
And I went back and I read a book that you wrote in 2019, Love Your Enemies. And I think it's a beautiful proposition. It's the Christian proposition on how to have dialogue, discussion. If you want to talk about it in Catholic terms right now, the buzzword is synodality.
Yeah.
What is it that we're missing in order to actually apply what you were talking about in 2019?
You know, working with students and young people and people active in politics and on the right and the left, one of the great lies that we have in our society today is to be transgressive, to be radical. you got to hate more. You got to hate your enemies more. There is nothing more traditional, conventional, boring than hating your enemies. It's the easiest thing that anybody can possibly do. And yet that's what we're telling young people to. Why? Because, you know, baby boomers are fighting some culture war and they're conscripting child soldiers into it by telling them to hate their enemies. The real transgression, the really radical teaching, if you want to be subversive, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. That is the most radical teaching that can truly transform anybody's life and our society. And once we go onto that path, wow, boy, that'll make you some enemies, by the way, that you'll have plenty of opportunities to love.
Spend more time on your knees praying for your enemies. Mm. You talked about your Catholic identity. Yeah. You don't hide it. It's really important to you. And yet, your partners in crime are Oprah Winfrey and the Dalai Lama. Explain that to me.
Oh, I've been so lucky. You know, since I've been teaching at Harvard and writing for The Atlantic, I've, you know, been able to work with so many interesting people. I have a book coming out in September with Oprah Winfrey. We've been working together on various projects. So she started reading my column during the pandemic and then read my latest book, which came out in 2022 called From Strength to Strength, and asked me to be on her podcast. And I did a television show with her, and we were just like a house on fire. And part of the reason is because she really wants to lift people up and bring them together. She wants to empower people to create more happiness in their own lives and more happiness in the lives of other people. And that's what I want too. But we come at it from different angles because she's in mass media and I work in the world of research. Mm-hmm. And she had this idea. She said, why don't we team up? Why don't we write a book for different kinds of audiences where we collaborate on what the message is? And I thought, Oprah Winfrey just asked me to write a book for her.
Yeah, she came to you. That's beautiful.
It was wonderful. And so, you know, we cooked it up in her tea house in Montecito, California. And then we went back and wrote parts and sent them back and forth to each other. It's coming out in September. I'm really happy with it.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. Yeah. I think that that's really going to be an explosive way for you to reach into the secular world in a way that other Catholics are either fearful of doing or don't know how or might not have the connections, the circumstance.
Yeah. Well, you know, the truth is that Catholic life is missionary life. And part of the reason is because we're walking around. We're not, I mean, you can go certain places where every single person that you meet is already a practicing Catholic, but that's not my mission. I'm not uniformed military. I'm a spy in plain sight. I need to walk around and live my faith because I'm in the mission field.
Yeah.
And I have to find better ways to get more deeply into the mission field. Why? Because I want to lift people up. I want people to feel this. I mean, more souls to heaven, it's just the best possible vocation that we can have, and doing it with our ordinary work, doing things that we love. What you're doing here on EWTN, what a joy it is, to be sure.
Yes.
And I'm, you know, I'm working in more secular institutions, but I get to talk about happiness, which people really, really want, and then introduce them to the spiritual source of their well-being, and it's great.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Well, I'm so grateful for your time, and I look forward to having you on EWTN a couple more times.
Thank you, Monse.
Thank you so much, Arthur.
There's much more of my interview with Arthur Brooks, including the wise advice he received from the Dalai Lama about his wife. For that additional clip, visit our Instagram page at EWTN News In Depth.
Our founder, St. Norbert, believed that the priesthood and holiness must always walk hand in hand.
Still to come, training the next generation of priests in the Norbertine way, inside St. Michael's Abbey, next. In this time of shrinking vocations, we visit one seminary where vocations are booming. St. Michael's Abbey in Orange County, California is one of the newest monasteries in the world. Correspondent Colin Flynn explores the inspiration that made the Abbey possible and the vibrant faith life for those living there in this Faith Journey report in depth.
When you think of California, you probably think of this. And perhaps not this. Well, just outside the City of Angels, St. Michael's Abbey prays to the angels of heaven.
It's the sort of perfect distance between the busyness of the city where we need to be doing our apostolic work and the quiet of the desert where we need to find Jesus in contemplation.
St. Michael's Abbey outside Los Angeles in Orange County is one of the newest abbeys in the world, having opened in 2021.
It's like heaven on earth. It's filled with the Catholic truth and the solemn celebration of the liturgy. It's a place to work out your salvation, to grow in virtue and to overcome your vices and help lead people to heaven.
Despite a decline in religious vocations in other parts of the world, here in St. Michael's Abbey, there is a vibrancy with 42 men studying for the priesthood and more waiting to enter. Why do you think so many men are attracted to the community?
Well, I don't think it's rocket science. We say our prayers, we wear our religious habit, we live according to the charism of our order and the traditions of our order, and we've never really given any of that up. And so that's why young people want to come and be a part of it.
The canons here are the order known as the Norbertines, with a history going back 900 years to France. Father Chrysostom Baer has been in the community for almost 30 years.
In 1121, St. Norbert founded our order as a kind of reform of the clerics of his time. It was another hard time for the church.
Et secundum multitudinem miserationum tuorum.
Our mother abbey in Hungary is called the Abbey of Csorna. There were 40 abbeys in Hungary in its heyday, and Csorna was always one of the most outstanding.
In July of 1950, the police warned the priests that they would be taken away under the communist regime and never be allowed return, as Father Norbert explains.
A small group of the fathers got permission from Abbot Eugene Simonvi to try to get out of the country and do something to keep the community alive elsewhere, especially if this was going to be the end, as they suspected.
That's what brought them to California, where they set up a monastery and secured the future of their order. Father Norbert has been in the community for almost half a century and has witnessed how it has evolved.
When I landed in 75, gravel parking lot, single-story buildings, no church, a few trailers, and here we are sitting in a brand new abbey on a completely different property. It's a miracle.
Today, there are 70 people living here in the abbey, of which half are priests and half are seminarians.
Those religious communities and those seminaries that are that represent authentic, full-bodied traditional Catholicism, the young people are flocking to it because it's exactly what the young people want. It's what the world needs.
What is your vision for a place like St. Michael's Abbey?
First and foremost, save souls and be a beacon of light and hope in a very strange land. A land that thinks that it's gone beyond God and doesn't need him anymore. So we're trying to fill that gap in the human heart with the truth of Christ and the love of the Holy Spirit.
I have my days when I cry, and I have my days when I'm sad by what's going on, but I never lose hope. If we keep our eyes on Jesus, we will never lose hope.
At St. Michael's Abbey in Orange County, California, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
The Norbertine Order reports more growth this week. Priests announced they are opening a new priory and educational institute in Springfield, Illinois. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. See you then.